Firstly, before I start, just to preclude, I see, just to preclude any kind of, you know, misplaced expectation, although I think most people who are, you know, familiar with me and with my policies and with my style understand that, you know, even though this is a talk that is taking place before the election, that I certainly would not presume to advise anyone how to vote, except that people should vote, you know, on the basis of their convictions and their conscience. As in most elections, and this one, I think even more acutely, it's easier to say and it's more difficult to figure out. And that's why it requires a great deal of cheshbon and nefesh for each and every one of us. Because typically, and again, this year, if anything, it's even more true, there are significant trade-offs and, you know, complexity because of multiple issues. And weighing them, especially since these are all issues that we care deeply about, whether it's support for Eretz Yisrael, the kind of values that we want to project more centrally in society, the kind of values that we want to reject, both policy and personality. It's a very complicated situation. But I would encourage everybody, you know, to reflect deeply, to vote on the basis of idealism and conviction, whatever, you know, conclusion you reach, and also just to vote, to exercise the right to vote, which is an important prerogative. Pragmatically, Jewish community should always vote in big numbers. And ideologically, you know, as citizens, that's a responsibility that we should be taking very seriously. Okay, now to the topic itself. The topic is wide-ranging, and we're only able to touch Rashi Prakim, but I would like to speak briefly, at least about two or three aspects of it. So let's begin. In the aftermath of the George Floyd killing this summer and recent other tragic occurrences that have dominated the headlines, these have served to spotlight the reality that racism in variety of forms, explicit and subtle, egregious and subconscious, specific, personal, and collective, systemic, that racism, an endemic, ancient, ubiquitous scourge or blight on otherwise ostensibly humane or advanced or humanistic societies, is something that sadly remains, notwithstanding significant progress in recent decades in the United States and our country, an intractable reality and force. Confronting this unattractive, disturbing truth has correctly inspired and provoked introspection among people of conscience to reflect upon the implications and to try to constructively identify and address the underlying causes, to try to redress injustices, the sources and manifestations of discrimination, of dehumanization, of structural and systemic inequality. As Bnei Torah, directed, of course, by Torah values, which obviously are relevant to all issues and especially to the important issues of any generation, it's important to state emphatically, clearly, that we abhor all dimensions of racial hatred, inequality, any forms of discrimination that are rooted in appearance, in biology, in ethnicity, etc. It's important that we unequivocally practice and project a policy of zero tolerance for conduct and attitudes that demean in word or deed, we'll talk about words in a few minutes, the stature and the dignity of others. This position is axiomatic, it's self-evident, and it's anchored in core principles going back to the Parshios that we're reading now, Bereshis, to the very beginning of time and creation, and then further codified in halachic principles and broader values as well. Though, unfortunately, for various reasons, it's not always sufficiently promoted and reflected unambiguously in our world. Competitive communal forces, priority or primary focus necessarily on our own internal challenges, and other complications, including tinges, or in some cases more, of anti-Semitism that are connected with so-called social justice movements in some cases, all these conspire to obscure this perspective, making it even more urgent that we review and we reflect upon the truth, which is that Torah Judaism allows no compromise in the absolute rejection of disrespect, demeaning, dehumanizing others. While many Jews were in the forefront of the civil rights movements of the 50s and the 60s, it wasn't primarily, you know, prominent Torah personalities. And that's why it's particularly important that specifically the Torah community, impassioned by Torah values, be in the forefront of articulating and advocating for greater respect, greater dignity and fairness and equality for kol mishpachot ha'adama. Again, historically, Torah Jews were a little reticent to get involved more directly in social justice movements because of the inclusion of political and other political and social agendas, which we found problematic, discomfort with tactics, and the questionable moral standings of some of the prominent leaders of those movements, as well as, right, I alluded to a couple of minutes ago, troubling undercurrents, in some cases explicit, anti-Semitism by some of the personalities or some of the tactics, some aspects of these agendas. And while these are understandable, eminently reasonable, we still need to find a way internally within our own community and in the broader arena to preclude any kind of misconception about the strength of our rejection of this absolutely toxic philosophy. And we need to find ways to constructively affect the broader conversation about it. So I just want to take a few minutes, first by invoking the famous Hakdama of the Mesilas Yesharim, where he declares that sometimes we ignore to our own peril and even abandon the most elemental truths because they are assumed to be self-evident. And I think this is a good example of that. So I'd like to briefly delineate some of the dimensions that establish this terrible scourge, racism, as something which is completely incompatible with our hashkafas ha'olam. It's certainly true that historically, as the prime victims of irrational hate and of persistent discrimination, we have an acute sensitivity to identification with other groups that share the same plight and a responsibility, right, to be clear in our support, in our insistence of them. The, you know, there's a famous, you know, poem, you know, that was written, you know, in the aftermath of the Holocaust. It was authored by Martin Niemöller, about the cowardice of German intellectuals and others in avoiding, you know, the harsh truth or admission of, you know, their abandonment of the Jewish people. First, they came for the socialists and did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists. I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me and there was no one left to speak for me. Very powerful words articulated by a non-Jew. But it is an important perspective, certainly. And as I say, as the prime victims of discrimination and hatred, the sensitivity to the Galgal HaChozer, if you will, cycle that ultimately undermines the protections of all people, that makes everyone vulnerable, is certainly a powerful argument. But this oft-cited pragmatic perspective against discrimination, while effective and true, right, is not the primary basis of our emphatic rejection of that toxic philosophy. The more compelling basis for our absolute obligation to fiercely oppose inequality and racism and discrimination is far more principled. It is rooted in our sense of justice, tzedek, emes, truth, that stands at the center of halachic law and life, and which is an acute sensitivity that demands total intolerance for any kind of victimization. The ger, the yasom, and the almana, who suffer systemic insensitivity and disadvantage by virtue of their status, merit the Rabbonu Sholem's special hashkacha and protection. And they demand our own protective orientation. You can't properly enjoy or observe Yom Tov or other edifying institutions of Jewish life, right, without being aware, in a hypersensitive way, of the plight of the disadvantaged, of those who are victimized by others. Of course, they highlight the theme that Oshek is not to be abided, and that the Ashuk has rights, and that we have obligations to him or her or them. The theme of Kigerim Hayisem Be'eretz Mitzrayim resonates with this acute hypersensitivity. And while these themes are primarily and normally and normatively mostly intra-Jewish, Ger Yosom V'Almana and Kigerim Hayisem, the broader principles and the wider sensitivities certainly apply on the level of humankind as well. Indeed, this brings us to the primary anchor, and that, of course, goes all the way to the beginning of Bereshis, the concept of Tzelem Elokim. Of course, the Torah, in the very beginning, when man is created, the creation, the first words uttered about humanity, and then and continuing to be a bedrock principle, is the concept that man was created B'Tzelem Elokim. The Mishnah in Masechet Avos, Paragimel, Mishnah Yedaled, speaks about Chaviv Adam, man, and the Mefarshim all note that we don't say Ish, we don't say Yehudi, right? The focus is on, you know, humanity per se. Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tzelem, Chiba Yisera Nodaslo Shenivra B'Tzelem. And it's fascinating that this is incorporated along with the two other concentric circles of Chavivin Yisrael Shenikur Bonim Lamakom, of Chavivin of Chiba Yisera Nodaslohem, and of course the third one, Chavivin Yisrael Shenitan Lahem Klichemda, which is a reference to the giving of the Torah and Torah observance. These concentric circles, Tzelem, Banim, Klichemda, are the basis for our conduct as human beings and as Jews. The first factor, Tzelem Elokim, remains a foundation of other. It wasn't eclipsed by Banim or Klichemda. It is, you know, the first rung, which was, you know, built upon. According to the Maral, a fascinating argument, not for now, but the Maral in Derech HaChaim on that mission in Avos sees overlap and intensification. He sees Banim Lamakom and Klichemda as, you know, heightening, right, the implications of Tzelem Elokim. While the Rashbats sees each of these rungs as discrete. But both of them agree about the critical continuing character of the core and of the foundation. And while there is lively debate about the essential feature of Tzelem Elokim. That's what is the factor that distinguishes man from other creatures and that stands at the center of the enterprise of the creation of the world. According to some, certainly the mystical view and the view of the Mekubalim and the view even of rationalists like the Ibn Ezra is that it's the divine spark, the ruach and the neshama that was implanted in man. For others, like the Sfarno, the Meshech Chachmo, the capacity for choice, which implies responsibility for our actions and our environment. For the Rambam and many others, it is the intellect and the capacity to take responsible positions and to move the world forward, the potential to apply sovereignty and leadership in the world, the view of Reb Sajagon, and implied by the psukim in the very beginning of Bereshis, the Rav's perspective that Tzelem Elokim is the basis for the charge of human creativity. Whichever of these, and they are not, of course, mutually exclusive, whichever of these define what is singular to humanity, to Adam, and to Tzelem Elokim, it is self-evident that all of them apply equally to all races and to all the peoples that make up humankind. Moreover, the diversity of men is something that is acknowledged from the very beginning and perceived as enriching the world and its goals. After all, Adam was created afar min adama. Chazal say that afar was gathered from arba kanfos haaretz, implying that sense of diversity and range as something which is wholly contributory, as well as being also from the makom of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, where the Aron is to be found. The concept of Shivim Lashon, of Shivim Umos, reflected in the Parim of Sukkot, the names of Yerushalayim, the Perushim of the Torah, Ba'er Hetev B'Shivim Lashon, the full range of cultures is something that is, again, commonplace in the worldview of Chazal. And it's clear that in Achris HaYamim, that range is intended to enrich, what will be a more idyllic era. The dignity and indispensability of each individual, the Mishnah and Masachet Sanhedrin, Kol HaMakayim Nefesh Achas, some have the girsa Nefesh Achas B'Yisrael, and that's certainly true. Others have the girsa simply Nefesh Achas, Ki Ilu Kiem Olam Male. And when we speak about, the calamitous, tragic, beginning of mankind and the murder, of Hevel by Cain, Dmei Achicha Tzoakim, this idea of Olam Male is implicit in that parsha as well. All of this highlights the potential stature, not only of each individual, but by extension, Kal v'chomer ben bno shel Kal v'chomer, of every legitimate culture, incompatible with there being inferiority or a clear hierarchy. The very notion that ethnicity, color, race, other biological or ethnic factors is a relevant factor is fundamentally incompatible not only with Tzelem Elokim, but with the entire spiritual orientation, the concept of Ruchnius, that of course is the crucial foundation of Torah life generally. Race and ethnicity is no barrier to Kedushas Yisrael, to Geirus. I don't want to go into the issue of Shevet Dan and the famous Tshuva the Radvaz, or the heroic rescue of the community of Ethiopian Jews by the State of Israel in more modern times. But it's absolutely clear that within Kedushas Yisrael, the notion that color, race, appearance, other biological factors would be of relevance is completely dismissed and rejected. The diversity of Shem, Cham, and Yafes in the rebirth of the world. And the parsha that we read last week, Parshas Noach, is absolutely clear in every way. Of course, the challenge of competition, hatred, war is endemic to man, even prehistoric in the story of Cain v'Hevel and in the machinations of the Dor HaMabul and the Migdal Bavel, when there was an abandonment of diversity, even in Migdal Bavel, a time of unity and harmony, but also a time of great crimes committed by mankind. Part of it is the abandonment of diversity and range, especially to promote a misleading unity, one based not really on harmony and comedy and uniformity, but a kind of cynical and destructive alliance, an issue that I hope to get back to. So that man's competitive and egoistic nature propel him from the very beginning to excesses. The Hamas cancer that we read about in the Mabul society of the beginning of Parshas Noach is rendered Hamas for good reason, implying that, you know, it includes a range of different motifs, as we'll get back to, but a corruption of the concept of Tzelem Elokim, a corruption of the role of language, Hamas Dibur, which we'll talk about again in a couple of moments, the disrespect, the character assassination, the unrestricted competition that led to disrespect and an undignified posture towards others, all of these engendered horrific onshim, exacting a terrible price, a mabul, a makeover of the world, a haflaga, etc. It's fascinating to note that there are three psukim in the Torah that focus on the principle of Tzelem Elokim. The first one, of course, is in the very beginning when man's creation, you know, takes place. In Perek Aleph, in Bereshis, Psukim Chavav and Chavzayin, the Torah tells us that man was created in the Ribono Shel'olam's image, as challenging as it is to understand, you know, what that means. The Pasuk declares that Bayas Elokim, Bayomer Elokim, Nasa Adam B'Tzalmenu Kidmusenu, B'Yirdu B'Dgas Hayam Ba'Of HaShamayim, Ba'Behema B'B'Chala Aretz, B'B'Chala Remes, HaRomes Al HaAretz, Ba'Yivr Elokim Es Adam B'Tzalmo, B'Tzalem Elokim Bara Oso, Zachar Nekeva Bara Osam. Then later on, when the Torah reviews or summarizes and highlights a different dimension of man's personality in his creation, we read again in Parakeh, Pasuk Aleph, once again, we read of this origin. Zeh Sefer Toldot Adam, B'yom Bra Elokim Adam, B'dmut Elokim Asa Oso. Not B'tzelem, but B'dmus, something which requires analysis, but not now. Chazal say that this pasuk is Zeh Klal Gadol B'Torah, at least according to Ben Azai. Fascinating. The first pasuk, of course, is the beginning of mankind, the goal and the purpose of the world. Yet it's fascinating that there's a third pasuk, and that's the pasuk in Parshas Noach, Perek Tes, pasuk Zayin. Here the Torah says, Shofech dam adam ba'adam damo yishafech, ki betzelem Elokim asah asa adam, v'atem pru revuv shirtzu ba'aretz urevuva. Having already established the principle of Tzelem Elokim, why was it necessary that the Torah repeat it in the context of Noach? Moreover, it's very fascinating that the mission of Avos that I cited earlier, which speaks about Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tzelem, instead of quoting that first seminal pasuk, or even the Zeh Klal Gadol B'Torah of Ben Azai, chooses instead to invoke the pasuk in Noach. And the question is why? But I think that there are several overlapping reasons for it that are relevant to our discussion today. Firstly, the initial principle of Tzelem Elokim right, did not preclude all of the, you know, disrespect, demeaning, dehumanizing, you know, that, you know, might have been expected. Tzelem Elokim, as initially formulated, in one respect, failed. It was consumed by that ego competition, by Hamas, and all that it implies. Moreover, precisely because it only explicated rights, privileges, sovereignty, the Yidgu, right, Bidgas Hayam, Ba'ofa Shamayim, the first formulation of Tzelem Elokim established man's sovereignty, his rights, and his superiority. But unfortunately, that didn't provide protection for vulnerability. That didn't limit, right, the parameters of competition. It didn't impose, frankly, any kind of security. Nor did it really establish a moral code that would give greater clarity, right, to what Tzelem Elokim really means. And the aftermath of Noach, precisely because he survives, but experiences the Mabul, and his task, his charge, is to reconstitute the world on a completely different basis, the Torah repeats the principle, the core of Tzelem Elokim, as if to say it previously failed, but it remains the bedrock. But more than that, the subtle reformulation establishes the protection of mankind, the prohibition against murder, the warning to animals, but more importantly, to fellow humans, that you cannot take a sacred human life, for the first time becomes anchored in the principle of Tzelem Elokim. Moreover, a reading of the Pasuk implies that one who takes another life, one who demeans or dehumanizes another human being, doesn't just strike, you know, is not just involved in criminal activity because he strikes a blow to that other person's Tzelem Elokim, but more so, he undercuts, undermines, basically neutralizes his own Tzelem Elokim. In Parshas Noach, we find that Tzelem Elokim requires morality, and it requires purposiveness, it requires respect, and a sense of identification and empathy with others. And therefore, when the Mishnah wanted to establish the three cornerstones of Jewish life, it begins with Adam, the universal, the Tzelem Elokim of Parshas Noach, and only then proceeds to Banim Atem LaShem Elokeichem, the more particularistic one, all of Klal Yisrael, and then more particularly the embrace of Torah values, Adam, who appreciates and is guided by the Klichemda of the Torah. The idea of Kol Mishpachot HaAdama that we include in the Yomim Noraim as a centerpiece is based on this principle. If we fail to be concerned for and to protect the vulnerabilities of others, our own Tzelem Elokim is undermined in the process. And that, of course, undercuts the foundation of being Banim and embracing the Klichemda as well. In the post-Mabul era, the need to reassert and reaffirm the Tzelem, to expand it significantly for both victim and aggressor, became foundational. But let's take this to a second level. The talk today, this is what I was asked to address, is about racism. We've spent a little time on that. There's much more to say. But it was also about politics and the state of the country. And there's certainly a lot to say about that as well. Given the gravity and implications of this offense, racial injustice, inequality, racism, etc., it's particularly disturbing to witness the ubiquity of racial politics on both sides of the ideological and political spectrum. And I want to make it clear, I'm not advocating, you know, voting preferences. I'm trying to be a social critic, a halachic social critic, and I think that there's plenty of criticism to go around on both sides. That doesn't mean both sides are morally equivalent in all issues. You know, I think we can make the case, you know, for each side of the political spectrum, you know, being more egregiously at fault when it comes to different criticisms. I don't want to get into those details. I don't think that's helpful for now. That's my private view. And I think it's much more important to just try to identify what is disturbing to B'nai Torah and how our own conduct and our own inculcation of values internally and as part of our responsibility to society, you know, can be constructive. The targeted employment of racial code words, of innuendos, you know, winking, you know, at, you know, racist concepts, you know, and principles, to stir further enmity, to exacerbate tensions in order to garner political support, common in old Southern politics and a hallmark of previous and recent and present presidential campaigns, is something that is indefensible and outrageous. It should be roundly and unequivocally condemned. Responsible leaders should be absolutely clear on the fundamental principle of racial equality and justice, just as we demand as Jews the unequivocal rejection, even though we don't often get it, of anti-Semitism. While not morally equivalent exactly, exploiting a noble cause like racial justice by dishonestly, even reflexively, cynically casting racial aspersions, labeling opponents who legitimately disagree on policy matters, also as a ploy for political gain, as racist, is a particularly despicable practice. Consider the hypocrisy, not only of intentional character assassination for people who know better, but of furthering the very racial hatred and tensions that supposedly motivate the outrage and criticism, right, that is foundational to those who lead the movement for social justice. Candidates have been known to accuse rival candidates of racism in a planned, calculated way, only later to join them as a political team. It's especially disturbing that this is just attributed to quote unquote politics as usual. One doesn't have to be naive to be offended to the core. Racial justice is a noble principle and a noble cause. It must translate into action and to policy. However, remedies, even assessment of factors, is typically a very complex endeavor. The equation of racism with police defunding, with reparations, with extreme affirmative action, or as some would call it, reverse discrimination, and a myriad of other policy debates is fundamentally dishonest. There can and are legitimate and compelling arguments relevant to these policies. I'm not taking position on them at the moment. Some of them are obviously extreme, and some of them are mostly, you know, things to consider. Again, the details, as far as I'm concerned, are not the issue at the moment. But the idea that there can be legitimate dispute, disagreement about policy that has nothing to do with racial bias and that should be immune or inoculated from the aspersions that are cast in those directions is clear. The tendency of character assassination and reflexive accusation is completely destructive to the goal of healthy debate and analysis, totally counterproductive to the ultimate goal of healing and promoting social harmony in a diverse society. Unfortunately, this is something which is extremely prevalent. Disturbing racial politics obviously include race baiting, which is most offensive, subtle or explicit, but they equally entail ignoring the colossal moral failings and ulterior agendas of individuals who shamelessly reverse race bait and movements that instigate violence in order to manipulate public policy, or that willfully ignore or cynically minimize or downplay criminal behavior, jeopardizing other vulnerable targets in the context of, and supposedly, you know, in the name of, social justice activism. The frenzied investigation out of context or decades-old missteps or misstatements, foolish youthful pranks, which may be reprehensible, frankly, or irresponsible utterances in order to shame, to destroy credibility, notwithstanding, assuming that this is the case, the absence of relevance to the situation in contemporary times or to the personalities in their contemporary reality is disturbing and dishonest. We encounter these posturings constantly. They're played as clips. You know, people Google candidates and people and, you know, what did he do when he was 10 years old and what did he say when he was 20? And so on, every mistake that people made. And, you know, they're replayed repeatedly. Obviously, even as people understand that people and cultures can evolve, that people can do tshuva, that utterances, you know, that are indiscreet don't necessarily reflect the total personality, certainly not in the present. These constitute the antithesis to the halakha's demanding subtle perspective on honesty and positive discourse. Midvar Sheker Tirchak demands that we reject misdirection, even when technically truth, facts, have been satisfied. It's a philosophy of honesty and of integrity that we hope becomes a model. At present, disturbingly, seems to be completely absent in our world. Sadly, racial politics merely mirrors the general political climate, characterized by extreme and polarizing posturing, a lot of dishonesty, by belligerence, and by contentiousness. The halacha appreciates deeply and considers it a cornerstone, even relishes fierce, passionate, principled debate. The Gemara in Kiddushin, Daf Lamed, Vahev Basufa, speaks about, you know, Ha'avu Beno, Harav Talmido, and the heated, you know, debates, you know, that look like Shanasim Oivim Zeze, the Mulchamta Shel Torah, loud, unrelenting, for time, giving the impression of hostility. But of course, the key there is that it gives way ultimately, Ein Zozin Misham, Achanasim Ohavim Zeze. The fine line between Oivim and Ohavim is something that Chazal play on, not generally, but at least in this context. The basis for examination and analysis and applying principled policy and applying halachic principles, of course, is debate and dispute and vociferous, spirited debate. At times, language can even be vituperative among Chachmei HaMesorah, the Baal HaMor and the Ravid, the Rajba and the Ra'ah, the Ravid and the Rambam, etc. Although, you know, the explanation always given is the principle of Kvod Shamayim Ani Doresh. We're talking about Dvarim Ha'omdim Berumo Shalolam, and sometimes that justifies a very spirited presentation. But in the end, they don't cross ever a certain line. And when we talk about Machlokas L'Shem Shamayim, we talk about Hillel and Shammai. As fierce the debate is, it's honest, it's not posturing, misleading. There's a common vocabulary and methodology and a single goal, not the lowest common denominator, but the highest, to attain and to live by Dvar Hashem. Notwithstanding occasional and initial tone, then, the core respect and dignity of Chachmei HaMesora for each other resulted, right, in magnificent partnership between Klal Yisrael and the Ribbono Shel Olam in the halachic enterprise. And frankly, even then, those who were most open-minded, most humble, respectful to others, in the end were accorded greater authority. Hillel, not Shammai, is normally the decisive voice in Psak, according to the Gemara in Erevin, because of this posture. Not as a reward to etiquette, that doesn't make any sense, but as a deep understanding that wisdom, perspective, and humility affirms conviction. If I continue to cling to my principled view after giving you a full hearing and a respectful hearing, then how much more compelling is my position in being weighed for Psak Halacha? Contemporary culture, sadly, has come to eschew any kind of bipartisanship. It's fascinating. Politics, the word politics, and the origins of political theory in the world of, you know, Greece, you know, Socrates and Plato and Aristotle and so on, is strongly associated with social mechanisms that promote efficiency, but that are practically synonymous with morality and justice. Unfortunately, the rejection of any kind of bipartisanship, even in a crisis, whether it be a pandemic or foreign policy crisis, wars and dangers, in order to score gotcha, you know, political points, facts and narratives that are almost completely incompatible and unrecognizable on each side of the political spectrum, and certainly irreconcilable. Ma'asim shebechol yom. You just have to take, you know, any two newspapers, you know, that represent, you know, the different spectrums of the debate. You're reading about a different world and a different reality. You know, if you watch television news, you know, go back and forth between Fox News and CNN. I don't have to tell you these, probably not. The cancel culture, the blogging echo chambers, conspiracy theories, each side accusing the other of disregarding truth, facts, and science, the phenomenon, because it's so loud and you know, suffused with conviction on both sides, is particularly striking and disturbing. The two central parties split along party lines, when was it, a year or a year and a half ago, in a vote on Supreme Court justice, in the supposed assessment, not of judicial policy or philosophy, which are totally legitimate issues to dispute, but and one of the issues that came up, which was about a mutually exclusive factual narrative of something that took place a long time ago that was probably unknowable in the present. Not ideology, not policy. And yet every single member of one party claimed to believe, talking about belief in facts, one narrative, and every other, and every member of the other party claimed to believe factually the other. That's completely inconceivable at any level that is real. The techno-prisoner, brook-no-compromise orientation of contemporary politics bodes poorly for effective governance at a time of especially important challenges, hence gridlock, but equally constitutes a toxic culture that further accentuates divisions and divisiveness, exacerbating disharmony, undermining the value goals of nobility and principle. This breakdown is further reflected in the common use of Hamas Dvarim, as Chazal understood the story of the Mabel. Violent rhetoric or invective, demeaning language, belligerent talk, which we have, you know, learned over, you know, sad experience, you know, is not only innately and inherently objectionable, but in addition, leads to violent actions, personal violent actions, national, global crimes, etc. In addition, it has the effect of generating unprincipled, purely pragmatic alliances based not on shared values and an edifying purpose, you know, of uplifting society, but a foundation for building and growth, but the lowest expedient common denominator. Chazal record that the Mabul, as I said before, was triggered by undefined chamas. Undoubtedly, as I said before, this word refers to a group of infractions, but more significantly, it refers to a culture and a core corruption of society. Part of that is chamas dibur, belligerent rhetoric, character assassination, crude language. These include extreme posturing, spinning, the manipulation of words and narratives that corrupt a world. Chazal, on the other hand, put a premium on the power and, by extension, responsibility of speech, communication, and articulation. Ruach memalala, right, which was infused into man, the basis of his Tzelem Elokim, is rendered by Unklus. I'm sorry, Ruach Chaim is rendered by Unklus Ruach memalala, the capacity for speech, which is also a capacity for articulation. The Gemara in the beginning of Psachim, which we're all learning, you know, spends quite a lot of time discussing the importance of language brevity, but especially of elevated speech patterns. Torah goes out of its way to avoid the word tameh, rather to say eno tahar, etc. All because Chazal understood that language isn't just a pragmatic, you know, tool or mechanism for communication to convey things, but it really goes to the core and heart of what man is really about. Korach v'Hadasso characterize machlokes shelo l'shem shamayim. Vayikach Korach, says Unklus, va'it palag. It's the politics of disruption and divisiveness, of divide and conquer. Korach postured and spun his narrative, well aware that it was inaccurate, and he did so for political gain. As the Malbim notes, very important ha'ara, a hallmark of machlokes is the fact that there is usually no real harmony among allies either, only mutual exploitation and the lowest common denominator. In my opinion, I alluded to it before, this is also relevant to the Dor HaFlaga. It sounds like they were united, but if you look carefully at the Psukim and the Mefarshim, their union was a pragmatic, expedient, and also a cynical one. It papered over significant disagreements. It came together for, an unholy alliance, a rare negative unity, though one which still is preferred from the outright antagonism and violence, the chamas, of the Dor HaMabul, the mutually exclusive competition that doomed that society. While the political and cultural climate at present have significantly deteriorated, as my time is up, as reflected by and further exacerbated by the tone of the upcoming election, whatever side one is on, and these are a source of grave concern, our charge and our challenge is certainly not to retreat and disengage, but rather to harness the gems of our Masorah, our values, ideology, as a constructive counterforce, certainly insularly from within, to protect, to cultivate uncompromising halachic principles within our own world, educationally for our children, to reinforce them in ourselves, but also in the marketplace of ideas and broadly in society. Jews have thrived and have flourished on the American soil because at its core, the American enterprise, and I believe this is still true for the overwhelming silent majority, this is a country which appreciates fairness, justice, and equality. And despite, of course, the historical shortcomings, including a an extremely problematic, imperfect record on equality. The United States, relative to other countries and cultures, has been a formidable beacon of values and idealism, and it remains that way. I've in recent years been reading, you know, some of the biographies, you know, of the early founders and some of the other great statesmen of the United States. They're religiously inspiring in terms of what humanity is capable of, men of vision and idealism, again, imperfect, inconsistent, as most men are, and also a function of a more, let's say, tone-deaf, you know, time or society with respect to certain issues. And that needs to be fairly calculated as we assess these imperfections. But in the end of the day, a country which is based on principles that are very much anchored and rooted in humanism and in Selam Elokim. And therefore, we should remain optimistic that our principled voices can make a difference in ways both small and large. Avraham Avinu was the first and the father of Klal Yisrael, but also held the title of Av Hamon Goyim. His involvement in broader society, the Battle of the Kings, his protective efforts to guide and later preserve Lot, right? Despite the great disappointment in Lot. Lot, in some respects, represents, you know, the caricature of the grotesque, you know, misapplication of Avraham Avinu's ideology. He could be a shofet in Sodom and try to practice, you know, hachnasas orchim there, you know, grotesquely offer his daughter, you know, to save his guests. That's what happens when you live in Sodom and when you pay lip service or you are superficially committed, you know, to the values of Avraham Avinu. But what's fascinating is that with all of that, Behu Yoshev B'Sodom, Avram didn't abandon even Sodom initially and never abandoned Lot. Avraham Avinu reflects a relentless optimism and determination to impact and to enrich all the concentric strata of his world. The Haftacha that we read of with respect to Avraham Avinu, V'nivru b'cha kol mishpachot ha'adama, that through him the world will be uplifted and blessed, a consequence itself of his uncompromising idealism combined with his wise, appropriate pragmatism when warranted. Avraham Avinu knew what the parameters of interaction were, when to be insular, when to be interactive. But he was, even in his pragmatism, never expedient. That's what characterized his approach. His reputation for integrity, dignity, responsibility is certainly part of the heritage that he bequeathed to his descendants, Lidore Doros. It's important that we prove worthy of that legacy so that we can reaffirm our commitment to the triple foundations of the Mishnah in Avos. Chaviv Adam Shenivra Betzelem, Chaviv Yisrael Banim Lamakom, Chavivin Anu, because of the gift of Torah Umitzvos of Klichemda. Okay, thank you very much. Kol Tov.
Thank you, Abby.